Good evening, and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Just for Freedom Estate. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author, Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African-American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
The most militant opponent of Booker T. Washington's philosophy of accommodation, a heroic fighter against discrimination, and the person who had more to do with originating and carrying out a crusade against lynching than any other, was Ida Mae Wells. At the early age of 19, as editor of the Memphis Free Press, she began her campaign against lynching. Threatened by white supremacists if she continued her exposure of lynchings, she defied them but took care always to carry two pistols for protection. In 1892, she published an article revealing that the lynching of three successful Negro grocers was the work of their white competitors. Her press was destroyed, and she would have been lynched had she not been in Philadelphia covering a convention. Miss Wells went to Chicago, where she joined the Chicago Conservatoire, and then lectured throughout the northern part of the United States and in Europe on lynching. She was among the first to point out the falsity of the charge of rape as explaining lynching. In 1894, she published A Red Record, the first book to document the crime of lynching. A year later, she married Ferdinand Lee Barnett of Chicago, lawyer and later first Negro assistant state's attorney in Illinois. In 1898, she was the spokesman for a delegation of women and congressmen to President McKinley to protest the lynching of a Negro postmaster. An active member of the Niagara Movement, she was also one of the signers of the call for the National Negro Conference in 1909 and later a founder of the NAACP. Mrs. Wells Barnett delivered the following address at the 1909 conference.
The lynching record of a quarter of a century merits the thoughtful study of the American people. It presents three salient facts. First, lynching is color line murder. Second, crimes against women is the excuse, not the cause. Third, it is a national crime and requires a national remedy. Proof that lynching follows the color line is to be found in the statistics which have been kept for the past 25 years. During the few years preceding this period, and while frontier lynch law existed, the executions showed a majority of white victims. Later, however, as law courts and authorized judiciary extended into the far West, lynch law rapidly abated, and its white victims became few and far between. Just as the lynch law regime came to a close in the West, a new mob movement started in the South. This was wholly political, its purpose being to suppress the colored vote by intimidation and murder. Thousands of assassins banded together under the name of Ku Klux Klans, Midnight Raiders, Knights of the Golden Circle, etc., etc., and spread a reign of terror by beating, shooting, and killing colored people by the thousands. In a few years, the purpose was accomplished, and the black vote was suppressed, but mob murder continued. From 1882, in which year 52 were lynched, down to the present, lynching has been along the color line. Mob murder increased yearly until in 1892, more than 200 victims were lynched, and statistics show that 3,284 men, women, and children have been put to death in this quarter of a century. During the last 10 years, from 1899 to 1908 inclusive, the number lynched was 959. Of this number, 102 were white, while the colored victims numbered 857. No other nation, civilized or savage, burns its criminals. Only under the stars and stripes is the human Holocaust possible. 28 human beings burned at the stake, one of them a woman and two of them children, is the awful indictment against American civilization, the gruesome tribute which the nation pays to the color line. Why is mob murder permitted by a Christian nation? What is the cause of this awful slaughter? The question is answered almost daily, always the same shameless falsehood that Negroes are lynched to protect womanhood. Standing before a Chautauqua assemblage, John Temple Graves, at once champion of lynching and apologist for lynchers, said, "The mob stands today as the most potential bulwark between the woman of the South and such a carnival of crime. The mob today stands as the most potential bulwark between the women of the South and such a carnival of crime as would infuriate the world and precipitate the annihilation of the Negro race." This is the never-varying answer of lynchers and their apologists. All know that this is untrue. The cowardly lyncher revels in murder, then seeks to shield himself from public execration by claiming devotion to women. But truth is mighty, and the lynching record discloses the hypocrisy of the lyncher as well as his crime. The Springfield, Illinois mob rioted for 2 days. The militia of the entire state was called out. 2 men were lynched, hundreds of people driven from their homes, all because a white woman said a Negro assaulted her. A mad mob went to the jail, tried to lynch the victim of her charge, and not being able to find him, proceeded to pillage and burn the town and to lynch 2 innocent men. Later, after the police had found that the woman's charge was false, she published a retraction. The indictment was dismissed and the intended victim discharged. But the lynched victims were dead. Hundreds were homeless, and Illinois was disgraced. As a final and complete refutation of the charge that lynching is occasioned by crimes against women, a partial record of lynching is cited. 285 persons were lynched for causes as follows. Unknown cause, 92. No cause, 10. Race prejudice, 49. Miscegenation, 7. Informing, 12. Making threats, 11. Keeping saloon, 3. Practicing fraud, 5. Practicing voodooism, 2. Bad reputation, 8. Unpopularity, 3. Mistaken identity, 5. Using improper language, 3. Violation of contract, 1. Writing insulting letter, 2. Eloping, 2. Poisoning horse, 1. Poisoning well, 2. By white caps, 9. Vigilantes, 14. Indians, 1. Moonshining, 1. Refusing evidence, 2. Political causes, 5. Disputing, 1. Disobeying quarantine regulations, 2. Slapping a child, 1. Turning state's evidence, 3. Protecting a Negro, 1. To prevent giving evidence, 1. Knowledge of larceny, 1. Writing letter to white woman, 1. Asking white woman to marry, 1. Jilting girl, 1. Having smallpox, 1. Concealing criminal, 2. Threatening political exposure, 1. Self-defense, 6. Cruelty, 1. Insulting language to women, 5. Quarreling with white man, 2. Colonizing Negroes, 1. Throwing stones, 1. Quarreling, 1. Gambling, 1. Is there a remedy, or will the nation confess that it cannot protect its protectors at home as well as abroad? Various remedies have been suggested to abolish the lynching infamy, but year after year, the butchery of men, women, and children continues in spite of plea and protest. Education is suggested as a preventative, but it is as grave a crime to murder an ignorant man as it is a scholar. True, few educated men have been lynched, but the hue and cry once started stops at no bounds, as was clearly shown by the lynchings in Atlanta and in Springfield, Illinois. Agitation, though helpful, will not alone stop the crime. Year after year, statistics are published, meetings are held, resolutions are adopted, and yet lynchings go on. Public sentiment does measurably decrease the sway of mob law, but the irresponsible, bloodthirsty criminals who swept through the streets of Springfield, beating an inoffensive, law-abiding citizen to death in one part of the town, and in another, torturing and shooting to death a man who for 60 years had made a reputation for honesty, integrity, and sobriety, had raised a family, and had accumulated property, were not deterred from their heinous crimes by either education or agitation. The only certain remedy is an appeal to law. Lawbreakers must be made to know that human life is sacred, and that every citizen of this country is first a citizen of the United States, and secondly, a citizen of the state in which he belongs. This nation must assert itself and defend its federal citizenship at home as well as abroad. The strong men of the government must reach across state lines whenever unbridled lawlessness defies state laws, and must give to the individual citizen under the stars and stripes the same measure of protection which it gives to him when he travels in foreign lands. Federal protection of American citizenship is the remedy for lynching. Foreigners are rarely lynched in America. If by mistake one is lynched, the national government quickly pays the damages. The recent agitation in California against the Japanese compelled this nation to recognize that federal power must yet assert itself to protect the nation from the treason of sovereign states. Thousands of American citizens have been put to death, and no president has yet raised his hand in effective protest. But a simple insult to a native of Japan was quite sufficient to stir the government at Washington to prevent the threatened wrong. If the government has power to protect a foreigner from insult, certainly it has the power to save a citizen's life. The practical remedy has been more than once suggested in Congress. Senator Gallinger of New Hampshire, in a resolution introduced in Congress, called for an investigation with the view of ascertaining whether there is a remedy for lynching which Congress may apply. The Senate committee has under consideration a bill drawn by A.E. Pillsbury, formerly Attorney General of Massachusetts, providing for federal prosecution of lynchers in cases where the state fails to protect citizens or foreigners. Both of these resolutions indicate that the attention of the nation has been called to this phase of the lynching question. As a final word, it would be a beginning in the right direction if this conference could see its way clear to establish a bureau for the investigation and publication of the details of every lynching, so that the public could know that an influential body of citizens has made it a duty to give the widest publicity to the facts in each case, that it will make an effort to secure expressions of opinion all over the country against lynching for the sake of the country's fair name, and lastly, but by no means least, to try to influence the daily papers of this country to refuse to become accessories to mobs either before or after the fact. Several of the greatest riots and the most brutal burnt offerings of the mobs have been suggested and incited by the daily papers of the offending community. If the newspaper which suggests lynching in its accounts of an alleged crime could be held legally as well as morally responsible for reporting that threats of lynching were heard, or it is feared that if the guilty one is caught, he will be lynched, or there were cries of lynch him, and the only reason the threat was not carried out was because no leader appeared, a long step toward a remedy will have been taken. In a multitude of counsel, there is wisdom. Upon the grave question presented by the slaughter of innocent men, women, and children, there should be an honest, courageous conference of patriotic, law-abiding citizens anxious to punish crime promptly, impartially, and by due process of law. Also to make life, liberty, and property secure against mob rule. Time was when lynching appeared to be sectional, but now it is national, a blight upon our nation, mocking our laws and disgracing our Christianity. With malice toward none, but with charity for all, let us undertake the work of making the law of the land effective and supreme upon every foot of American soil, a shield to the innocent, and to the guilty, punishment swift and sure.
So the mom and them had to be gathered up and all her hands were put in this commissary. And she had a young baby that bone. So my sister was my sister. And they smothered her out there. Because so many people was in there, you know, hate the other heat, you know. So it got hotter and hotter with all these bodies. Because so many people in this small area. So I lost a sister in this room because they had to be God. The boss man had to stand outside the commissary. That's where the railroad. See, it wasn't no highway. You got a highway there now, but it wasn't no highway there then. Okay? What you see now wasn't there. 24 was there, but it wasn't paved. So there was a dirt road, and people were coming from out of state. Everywhere coming, killing black folks, all the way from Gainesville, all the way forth. If they seen a black person side of the road, he was dead. So in order to save them, they had to guard them. They stood outside the road, and then somebody come and said, keep going, don't stop here. This is not Rosebud. A lot of people didn't know Rosebud from nowhere else. All they know there's some black folks, so they want to kill them. And so that's what happened at an elder problem. But my mother lost my sister because they wouldn't pay us nothing, but they said you had to be in Rosebud in order to get some money. So we tried, but they wouldn't do anything about it. But this is one of the worst atrocities. Mama said this thing lasted for a week, and then just nothing but red. You can see red down there where they burned the houses. And a lot of the people that I got to know that was just, dang it, her dad and all that. I'm sorry about it. I'm old now, I can't get it out that way. You know. But her dad and all of my new old, I got to get that to know Luke. He roots to have her up there, just followed up. I knew her from a distance, you know, I didn't know her close to prison. But she used to come down there once to watch your brother, because he moved down the creek. Well, that kid, young man, go on. It had two black people that left working in the commissary, picking up the time for them guys. Said, her dad was well educated. He could have run them people right on down, one of them little realm, you know. But, you know, that people in the Rosebud was well, most of them well educated. Nice neighborhood. They had everything down there. Amen?
Amen.
And that's the story of my little story about Rosebud. Mama and them survived that because they had to guard them because they needed you to work. And you and the animals was on top. It was top priority. They needed the horses and the mules, and they needed black people to do that manual labor. If it was lack of the other day, they would have killed them all, but they don't need them no more. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Joanne and Scott. Well, we have Janie Bradley Black, Blake. You know, put all the names, John. We didn't forget. And she is the president and our director of the Rosewood Heritage Foundation. And she's from Miami, and I'd like you to give her a hand as she comes forward.
Give you greetings, and thank you for allowing us to take a part in this great part of history. Everyone has done such a marvelous job. I am very well pleased, and I have a lot to carry back and talk with my 125 seniors where I am employed. I want to thank my husband, John, for being so patient. I didn't feel well. Told him I didn't want to come. And once I got here, I was ready to turn around and go back to Miami. But the longer I stayed, the more I heard. Well, I figured I owe it to my ancestors to say something. And on their behalf, because that's the purpose of the Rosewood Heritage Foundation and being with this great group of people. My grandfather, John Wesley Bradley, my grandmother, Virginia Carrier Bradley, two people who are instrumental in having me to know that I am somebody. I came from somewhere, and I belong to a great group of a family. My father, Mr. Scott, said, and he and I have known each other for years, he knew my father. Some people call him Gavester. Others says Nader, but I've also gone to the underground and searched the records, and they have him listed as Nathan. I don't care what the name is. I know who I am, and I'm very proud. My grandfather was the father of 9 children in Rosewood. And I got a chance to meet all of those children except one, and that was my uncle, Wesley James. Now, the families of the Bradleys, the Carriers, the Colemans, the Edwards, the Evans, the Goings, the Robinsons, and the Holes. Now, for some reason, the whole family has been left off of the lineage, but we have a living survivor here with us today, and I think she's probably about 96 years old. She's somewhere 94, but I know she's nearing 100. Her name is Mary Magdalene Hall Daniel, and she's alive in the town of Hillview. So by that, you know, I'm very close keeping contact with the family members because I need to still know what they can tell me that will make me even stronger. Now, getting back to Rosewood, I was born in Levy County, and my father did not leave Levy County, the town of Otter Creek, until I believe the year 1964. So I had close ties, knew a lot of people who maybe didn't want me to know them. The Yettis, John and Mary Yetti, were the post office keepers during that time. There was a grocery store, Mrs. Scott, who I mentioned. My father was, I guess you would call him the butcher, the delivery man, whatever. But that was, he was also employed for the West Brothers. And they were big people in that town. So a lot of the stereotypes that some of our children have experienced coming up, I think that kind of protected me and my younger siblings, and there were 8 of us, or 9 of us, in Otter Creek, or have lived and visited there. It's wonderful to know who your family is, how did you become related. My grandfather's son, or my daddy's brother, Hoyt, married one of Mr. Hall's daughters, Dosher. They lived in a little town called Wiley. So there are 2 towns between Otter Creek and Rosewood that have not been mentioned. Wiley is one. But there's another one because the Burns, my cousin Adolphus Burns and his wife lived in this little town. She was a beautician there. And so many of the families that had to flee from Rosewood, the men, the boys, they couldn't get on the train, had safe refuge, if only for a short time, from Rosewood to Otter Creek was Mr. Scott's family and Mr. Henry Strong family, and that's a family that's in Otter Creek now. And I believe there were about 17 of those children, and I believe 15 or 16 of them were boys. They worked on the railroad. So these men and boys had a way, if they could get to the track, those kind of cars that you would pump and push, that they would have the cross ties on, they hid them between those cross ties. Many of them were fed and protected by families from the great Gus Hammock. McGinnis had a mill there, so the men all worked together. Everybody knew everybody around there, because from a little girl, I used to walk the 6 miles from Gautama to Otter Creek if I wasn't picked up by the mailman or some trucker going along or somebody who was just nice enough to give me a ride. That's what got me into Miami, because I was one of those children with their mind of her own would leave very nosy or interested in wanting to know what was just around the corner. Now, my mother, Jane Bell Monroe, lived in Gautama, Florida. That's just around the Waukesha River, or the Suwannee River, or 98 to 19 into Otter Creek. So everybody knew everybody. One of the ministers that was in Rosewood, my older brother had an illness, so we used to go down to Rosewood, and he would pray for him. He his granddaughter, I believe, became the mayor or some congressional person in Otter Creek, but they let the minister, move to Cross City. But that didn't stop us from going to Rosewood. I knew the Scoggin real well. We would travel from Miami to Rosewood many times just to go to City Key to get fish. So I'm one of those that knows the berries that grow, when to harvest, how to can, and have plenty to eat. The deer tongue, I picked that. So if anybody wanna say I wasn't there, I helped to pick deer tongue. I pulled moss from the trees. So I'm one of those children that if you turn me loose in the wilderness, I will find my way, because I was taught on what side to follow the moss growing on the tree. But you had to be smart enough to learn to listen and look and watch where you walk in those woods. Because there was plenty of rattlesnakes, coach whips, wild hogs, and many other bears and all of that in the woods. So the men were very good hunters. When they came to Rosewood, they came in from the Carolinas. We became open with Rosewood because of my cousin, Annette Turner-Goyne, 18, Leroy Bradley Davis. As far as I was concerned, she was the one that I needed to have to tell her story. I'm the mother of 6 children, five of them are boys. We've taught them how to hunt, how to use their weapons. We go down to visit my father on a summer vacation after hearing me talk about all the land that Bonnie was Bradley on, 375 acres. John Wesley Bradley, 175. They're going, obtaining 600 acres. There were cousins who owned the acres here, 235. And the kids get there, and it's barbed wire, no trespassing. I was instrumental in talking my Aunt Ruth into telling her story. Well, you don't want to open up a can of worms. Nobody's going to believe me if I do. Well, I knew enough people in and around Otter Creek, Gautama. There was a family that bought 600 acres of land from New York. Moved into Rosewood without even knowing what had happened, never heard of the tragedy. Yes, I call it a massacre. To me, it was a massacre. Anytime you kill innocent people without cause, That's an accident. You're taking away something you cannot give, and you did not give. You can't replace. When I looked through a scrapbook of pictures that Kathy and my cousin Annette and Dr. Zimmerman made of Rosewood, it made me feel very good. And then I think about her standing on the bridge all alone, crossing her arms and looking at the water. And I wonder to myself, what did she see? Talking and being around her, she was my mentor. Got me into doing what I am doing today because I refuse to let Rosewood die.
Yeah.
I promised my aunt that I would talk about it, whether anybody wanted to hear it, because I had to hear it coming up from John Wesley Brett is sitting on the front porch in that rocking chair with his cane hanging on the back singing, "That awful day will surely come." And he would start talking about that old story that I didn't want to hear anymore about. But I'm glad I listened. Because I am teaching my children, my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren of their heritage. I want them to know that they are a part of Rosewood. Each of you in here have been affected by Rosewood, whether you believe it or not. There are some good white folks and there are some bad white folks. She said, but I don't want to be closed in around them anymore. We still have family members. This auditorium should be full of family, and we got them. Because we just had our 26th family reunion in Fayetteville, North Carolina. And there were more than 500 of us there, and that wasn't all. So it should be full. But you kind of get away. You don't want to hear. Maybe people don't believe. And yes, we all have a story to tell. Theirs could be different than mine. It doesn't matter. I'm speaking of that which I have been taught, that I know. And then I look at some of them and I say, well, you know, you may have read it because somebody else printed it, but how much is it true? Because after all, I was already here when you were born. That's where you get to organize and revamp and read over things. We have taped information from interviews from family members, and we created the Rosewood exhibit. There's one at Bethune-Cookman University, so if you want to see some of the things, some of the artifacts, pictures, and just read up or listen to one of the tapes there. And if you have any feedback, or if you have anything you disbelieve or can prove that isn't so, we're going to hear from you. I do have in my heart, Rosewood is there. I love my family. I didn't choose to be born there, but I'm a part of it. The good, the bad, the ugly, and the indifferent, I'm a part of. And I believe I'm one of the, as Dr. Zimmerman said, one of the multicultural generations. The one thing that I have learned is to learn your culture and teach your mind. And this is our land. God gave us one earth. He made it possible for us all to live together. Let's make it a happy place. Because that was the intention. I want to thank God for our president. When he chooses his cabinet, we are going to cover them in prayer because that's what we were brought up on. One God, one faith, one baptism. He's the paymaster. He wants us all to enjoy this land. Let us come together, be Republican, Democrat, liberal, those other people from Palin, and yes, I've been to Alaska, so I know I didn't see Germany in the back, yeah. That was one thing I needed to really know. See, we claim, but we need, after confessing, we need to stand. Let us stand together. Let us be good Americans. Let us remember Rosewood is, Rosewood was, Rosewood will forever be. Let's keep Rosewood alive. Thank you.
So that's the monument that you need to look at. You go on that site and you'll see it.
and it's real. And I talked to two divers that have been down there and they've seen it. I haven't. I don't plan to go. But it is there. It's a commemoration. So those are the kind of things we need to know about and share with our youth and show them these pictures and make them aware that there's a lot going on. A lot has gone on. And a lot is known that we don't know. But it's coming forward. All right. Mr. Brandon, are we ready to go? All right. Who's first?
He is.
But do you have his?
Yeah, that's his.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to advance it for him.
Oh, fantastic. I'm sorry, I haven't been talking. I thought you all were working, trying to get the equipment ready. All right, well, let me introduce Mr. Isaiah Branson, Reverend Branson, a friend of mine. We've been friends for many years. We've rode the roads together, looking at houses. He's carried me to the fields, the situations that were not safe, carried me to graveyards. We've been in many places. Some places where we didn't have good services, but that's all right. We were there, and God was with us. And I wanted to present to you Mr. Isaiah Branson, a historian and a genealogist. Please come forward.
Greetings, everybody. What I'm going to talk about now is the hidden stories. I'm an inquisitive person. When I was young, I was very inquisitive. Right out of high school, I didn't know where my people came from, but my grandmother they moved to Sisters County. And one day, I'm inquisitive. Grandma always said I was inquisitive. So one day I went to the house. She was sharing peas. And she was on the porch. She was about 85. She lived to be 102. And I was asking about her family. And I am the great nephew of Mandy Price. And Robert Sugg was his best friend. So I was talking to my grandmother, and I said, I'm going to do this with the heart. I'm not going to use a script or anything. And I was talking to grandmother, so I started asking her, where are you from? She said, well, from Gainesville. I was born in Gainesville in 1800. So we started talking, and one thing, my grandmother was very intelligent. She could read and write. She was she spoke fluent. And so I asked her, who is your family? Where are your brothers and sisters at? She started naming the one in Tampa and different places who was dead and who was living. So I said, who was your brother? So she broke down. She put her head in her hand and she started saying, they didn't have to kill that boy that way. So I said, Grandma, what you talking about? I said, well, you don't have to talk anymore. She said, no, they didn't have to kill that boy that way. And I said, who? She said, Mandy. She said, they took that boy and killed him. And I said, why they killed him? She said, Mandy used to love the word. I'm talking grandma now, I'm talking in the spirit. And she said, Mandy used to love the word, and he went to plow field one day. So his uncle had taught him how to run a mule. He was about 10 years old. And he had told him to plow three rows and come out of the field. So Mandy came out the field after he plied three roads. And Robert Sugg was waiting on him. They were friends. They were going to walk back to the house together. Mr. Cook noticed him because he had been working in the other field. He noticed that Matt stole his coat over his shoulder and began to walk. But what happened, they went by a watermelon field and they stopped there for a little while and they bust the watermelon and started eating the watermelon. And then what had been going on for a couple of days, three or four white teenagers were killing hogs, taking what they want to eat and leaving the carcass, leaving the rest of it out there laying in the field. During that time, they had a law against cattle rustling. They were, you could get put in jail or you could get hung. So during that time, when Manny was walking, leaving the three or four white guys who were doing that, they ran behind Manny and they caught him. And it was in Half Moon, Florida. Half Moon is east of Newberry. It's a town that is about 3 miles from Newberry to its site. And my grandmother Susan lived there because they done peace work. They done work. You know, back then they had to go from one little place to another picking peas, cucumbers, whatever it was to survive. Right. So at that time, my grandmother Susan, which was born in 1857, was living in Adloon. And Mandy was living with her. My grandmother, Lizzie Carwell Jackson was living with her, and my grandmother, and then Stella, their other daughter. So what happened when they got Mandy, Mr. Cook went and told Susie, they got your grandson, they've been in Lincoln. So Susie, next screen, please. And that's Mandy Graves. I'm going to go with protocol, but I want to get it out. That's Mandy Graves. We visited the grave, my grandmother visited the grave, but she never wanted to put a stone on it because she didn't want to bring that stuff up around Newberry again. But she would go there, we'd go periodically, and she would break down, and we'll pick up, and she would get back up and carry back to the car. But during that time, Linton, he was lynched September 2nd, 1902, and buried September the 3rd, because it was late at night when they cut his body down. And they put him in a wagon, and then Robert Flood was hung also. And they put him in a wagon and took him back to their to Susie's house, and they let him, they built a coffin, a wooden coffin, and they put him in there. But you know, Manny was a working boy, as grandmother would say, and he was a type of guy that wasn't lazy. And so what happened? See, the farmer noticed the cattle was slaughtered. And then Robert and Robert Sons were the only two boys near the ground. Mm-hmm. But what happened, he lived near the ground and had no much of white guys, about three or four, who slaughtered the cattle. You Manny and Robert Sons, there was a scapegoat. They called him, the teenage boys, called them two boys, about four or five of them, ganged him up and took him to Mr. Dudley. And Mr. Jeffco, which was a local community, next thing please. And they took him and they gave him over to the auditor. Mr. Dudley, they took him, they had the guns and everything, said, well, you know, we're going to take you up here and we're going to deal with you. And as grandmother was saying, Mr. Cook noticed it when he went to Susie just called, they got your boy. And they taking him up to Lynn to hang him. And grandmother said, during that time, they all got the cattle. She put some over her and said, come on, baby, let's go. And she picked up and started running. And when she got to the Lynn's hammer, they had him up on the horse with the rope around his neck. So Lindsay just went forward. So they knocked her back and kicked and broke her ribs and beat her up real bad. But she still was trying to reach out for the horse. And they said, Mr. Dudley, he hit the horse, and when he hit the horse, Manny was hung, and grandmother said she heard his snake snap, and she looked around, and she said his eyes were buzzing, and she said she began to cry and break down, everybody was breaking down, and my grandmother told me, she said, when Billy Holiday came out with the song, strange fruit,
yeah,
with buzzing eyes, and she would cry. She couldn't hear that song because it reminded her of brother Manny. And so at time I told grandma, now why y'all don't go to the grave and put the stone on the grave? She said, because we don't want the people locally, they're so prejudiced now that if we put that stone on, there's no we trying to bring up something. She said they also put in the paper that he was a murderer. He was accused of murdering a cop. And she said, but he didn't do anything. She said the Dudleys was so evil people that she said, but what during the hanging, this one got me. Grandmother said during the hanging they had about 100 white folks there with their children on their shoulders. Just to rejoice. Said the kids was all on their shoulders like it was a party. She said, you could have saw the children on the people's neck. They holding the children up on the neck. Look at them. And she said they was teaching their children evil, what to do. I'm serious. Grandma said she said all the children were with their parents watching the hanging, and they was all saying, kill that nigger, hang that nigger. And she grandma said they was
pardon of killing them children. The Bandit was 10 and Robert Fuzz was 12. Next screen, please. And then she was so sad, the death of her brother. In the census, I got them in the census with a 1 year apart. I have the census with Dilly, Landy, Estella, Willie, and Cherry. There were my great aunt and my great uncle. I got the census with all the names on it. And that was in 1900. That was 2 years before this death. And my grandmother really, she told me, she said, you know, I can always see my brother's eyes. She said, I can lay down at night and see his eyes buzz. She said, I never could get his eyes out of my mind. And when she was 98 years old, I never forget, we had a family reunion, and they was going to take her picture. So she had a baby in her arm, and the white photographer came to get the baby. She said, no, don't take it. She had a flashback. Don't take that baby, you're going to do something with it. You're going to kill it, you're going to hang it. She just had a complete flashback at the age of 98, thinking about men. And they carried him after he was hung, Mr. Cook. Excuse me, I guess get back on the mic. Can y'all hear me?
Yeah.
Mr. Cook went ahead of the wagon and the horse and went and picked up the body. And they buried him at St. Mark, had a short funeral, and they put him away. That's not in Black Church. It's a step right on the left-hand side. That's where the original church he was buried in. That grandmother, when we went out there, she showed us where the steps was at, right inside that church. And she said, that's the original church he was buried in, but this one on the side was built later. So, next thing, please. And Robert Fudd died from his mansion. He was buried in the Stalls Field. Robert Fudd's family had property out there, and they buried him in that field, open field. My grandma said when they was leaving, after her brother had been hung, Robert Fudd was hollering for his mother and weeping and calling his mother out, "Mother, please help me, help me, help me." And all of a sudden, they walked around the corner. They heard when you can hear the letter snap. She said, "You can hear it," and that's when you know that they've been killed. And she said, "Went home and next day, please." And those were at the hanging in September 2nd, 1902, in Lynchhammond, in Newberry. There was my grandma Susie Kennedy Jackson. She was born 1857, died in 1928, December the 24th, a day before Christmas. Lindsay Carwell Brooks, Gaines. She's 1876 to 1912. She didn't live too long because she was beat. They really beat her really bad. She get over there and she died. The injuries and the scars. And Dilly, my grandmother Dilly, 1892, she died in 1993. And I have pictures, that was Mandy's sister. I have pictures of her when she was a little girl. I have pictures of her mother when she was a little girl. I have pictures of Susie. I got pictures of all those people. I have pictures. Of her daddy. I have pictures all the way back to 1812 of my family. I even got a picture of Mandy when he was a little boy and my grandma together. That picture's called the Gaines picture, but during the time the Gaines family was in Gainesville was a friend of ours, Henry Gaines, and my grandmother lived in all of them was friends and Susie. So they got a picture of a man on the porch as a little boy. Also got a picture of Mandy working with my uncle Duval, John Duval, in the print shop, where he loved to work. And Mandy was a little short fellow, but he was a little nice little boy. And she said that, but I know that God will keep him and he's going to be in heaven. She said, but this tragedy in the family, she kept it to herself. And that day she broke down. And from then on, she started talking to me about the entire family. She started opening up. And I think I did something good for her. I got
some of it. But she did so much, she broke down so bad that I had never seen my grandmother in that fix. And it looked like she'd been holding it for at least about 7 years. I go to Manly Grave, but we haven't put the stone on there. I was thinking about I need to put something there, but I really got to. It's difficult for me to talk about it because it really, really broke my grandmother down. I never in my life saw it in that much, you know, despondent. So what I'm letting y'all know, I go to the older people and go and ask questions. Ask who, where you come from. What happened in the family that I need to know about? How can I motivate my children about our history? It could be negative, but this thing, Grandma told me, she said, baby, don't take this for hatred, but take it for a lesson. She said, never take something evil and turn it around for something bad. You know, you make a example out of it. You let your children know that you had an uncle named Manny. You had already was 10 years old when he died, but he lives in your heart because he lived in life. It's sad when I think about it, and that's what she said. She said, but when I think about it, I think about his smile when he was a little boy. I think about how he used to catch his hand and walk him when he didn't know where he was going. She said, but I know God got him in his arms. She said, that's what assured me, because he was an innocent person that died for no cause. That because he was a black boy, him and Robert Sullivan walking together. She said they got out of the field and went on home, still stopping to get the watermelon, busting the watermelon and eating it. They went in the car and they caught him eating the watermelon. They said, there you go, let's get him. And that, she said, he probably would have went on home and didn't stop. But she said she can't make no excuses like that because he was in God's hand. Thank y'all.